Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 15, The Forbidden Forest.
Okay. What a chapter.
Dude, I would say compared to the last chapter, which was completely bonkers, this one I was just like, I love this chapter. There's so many cool things happening in it. Oh my gosh.
Peak Harry Potter.
It's just, yeah, there's some very good stuff happening along the way in here. Although on the complete opposite end of things, we talked about the chapter art last time with Norbert the Norwegian Ridgeback being just like one of the best chapter arts.
Yes.
I gotta say, we got a complete one as like chapter art to chapter, we've done a complete 180. Whereas for this one, we've got a centaur. I'm not sure which one it's supposed to be, Bane, Ferenczi, or
I think
Ronan.
It's Ferenczi. I read it as Ferenczi.
I read it as, yeah, probably. He's like the more main character centaur. Yeah. But I got to tell you that like the way this centaur's arms are being depicted, like they do not, to me, convey like the seriousness of any of them. Like
right yeah, like these he's got like his arms out sort of like angles that would suggest that this is the type of creature that speaks with its hands.
Yeah, you know? Like he's like a big gesturing, like he doesn't have the right demeanor or something. Like even Ferenczi, who's like the nice one, is still like being pretty serious. Like, you know, he's taking a lot of courage to stand up to the other two and go against the stars and stuff.
Right. They seem more stoic. This seems more like a creature that may have like popped out of the woods with like a set of pipes and started like, you know.
Yeah, right.
Like breaking out of tune or something.
Right. It looks more like a half satyr, half horse, you know.
Yeah. I see what you're going for. So, yeah, unfortunately, maybe not the best artwork, but otherwise a pretty good, if not a little bit hypocritical chapter.
Oh my gosh. Number of times in this one where it's like, boy, Hagrid, you sure are lucky that Harry like blames himself, because Harry is basically not at fault at all. And if he wanted to throw you under the bus, I don't even think it would be throwing under the bus.
No, yeah. Just quite literally, can I please explain the situation?
Yeah, can I explain the situation? The fact that Hagrid, you know what? Harry does not say Hagrid had a dragon. But do you know what Hagrid doesn't do? Say, Professor, it was me. I had a dragon.
I know. You know? Yeah. And then he's like a little bit like still like all very like authoritative. So anyway, let's give everybody the overview. The Forbidden Forest, in case you have forgotten, is a chapter that basically delves into the detention that Harry, Hermione, Neville, and Draco all have to go on together, mm-hmm. as per being found out in the middle of the castle in the middle of the night, the evening that they attempted to send Norbert off with Ron's brother Charlie's good mates.
Yes.
And so this is the punishment, of which the overlying extreme irony is that they are in trouble for being caught out in the middle of the castle in the middle of the night and how dangerous that could be. And their punishment is to meet at 11 o'clock at night, where they are to go into a place referred to as the Forbidden Forest.
I know.
With the very person that Harry is like
in trouble for helping.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my gosh. It is ridiculous. And the fact that at the very end of the chapter, Dumbledore sends back the invisibility cloak to Harry is just like, yeah, I knew.
Absolutely, I knew what was up. Absolutely, he knows that. Like, to me, that is like one of those things where I may have even written it down somewhere along the way where I was like, "Does Dumbledore like know that the reason that What am I trying to say here? Does Dumbledore know that the reason why they're in trouble is because Harry was trying to do the right thing and help somebody?
Got to. I mean, yeah. there's no way that Dumbledore knows that Voldemort is, that Quirrell is working with Voldemort, but doesn't know that Hagrid has a dragon.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right. No, exactly. And so here's the thing too, is that like, so they get in trouble for doing this particular thing where we literally just witnessed McGonagall capturing Draco in the act of being out in the middle of the night, where she takes 20 points.
20 points from Draco.
From Draco. And then she finds Neville, who is out in the middle of the night looking for Harry and Hermione, and takes 50 points each from them.
Like, why doesn't Draco also lose 50?
Right. This is like one of those chapters where I'm like, I feel like what's actually going on here is that McGonagall basically is super upset that her students have behaved poorly and is almost more upset with them being extensions of House Gryffindor than she is with Draco, who is not under her like per diem, so to speak.
Maybe. You know, more upset with herself.
Maybe.
Look what first years I have, you know, brought up here.
But to me, this feels like the exact opposite of what I think Snape might do in similar circumstances. So it's also like, is this the actual reason that Slytherin is always winning? Because like McGonagall's like, at the end of the day, like, of course I want to win the House Cup, but like also I want to ingrain into you behaviors that will help you as you progress and are representatives of this fine house for all of the future.
Right, like in the real world, you don't get out of jail free cards. And Snape's like, yes, but I can't. I do have these get out of jail free cards, and you know what? In the real world, if you know the right people, sometimes you do get them. So
right. And Snape seems like he would have had the kind of schooling where maybe he would have coveted peaking in high school a little bit, and so maybe he is like attempting to give that to his Slytherins. It's like, ah, yes, you answered that question correctly. Probably 50 points is more than enough.
50 points. Why there not? You go. Well done, Crab.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. The other thing that I think to keep in mind about this. This taking of the 50 points is that everybody loves the whole like, oh, Dumbledore totally loves Gryffindors and he totally calculates the exact number of points that they need in order to win the House Cup.
Oh yeah, but like, what's really happening is that the ending is being set up for the House victory.
Yes, yeah. It feels like that's exactly what's going on. Like Gryffindor needs to be winning all throughout. This is exactly like the Rocky movies, if you've ever tuned into any of those, the Creed movies.
Yeah.
It's like you always have to have the main boxer somehow simultaneously be the reigning champ and the underdog.
Right.
And it's like, how is the reigning champ the underdog in all of these battles? And it's like, because you want to be cheering for the underdog, you can't have like the reigning champ going in there and just like beating somebody up. And,
right, exactly.
And so I feel like that's exactly what's happening here. It's like, you need Gryffindor to be excelling. You need Harry to be good at Quidditch and consistently earning points and doing all of the right things. And then you still need a reason for them to need to come from behind.
Exactly.
But also, is there any part of you that's just sort of like, maybe Dumbledore is like, by the end of it, he's just kind of like, look, I needed an excuse to give some of these points back, because really on especially Hermione and Harry, like, they were helping someone out. Okay.
Right. Like, okay. I know the full story here. They really shouldn't have lost those 150 points.
Right.
You know, like, we'll make up for it. It's cool. You know what? Draco lost those 20 points. When you give those 20 points back to Slytherin, it's cool. Harry gets 60. Neville gets 10. There's 20. Yeah, okay, we got it. We're good.
Math. Yeah. You know, he's just got a piece of parchment up there.
Yeah.
Just like scribbling like Harry the 3. Anyway, so that's the premise for chapter 15. Do you want to start with our page by page?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. So I love the very first sentence here. His things couldn't have been worse. And by the end of the... like the end of the page, it's like, things are worse. Neville's in trouble too.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. So the first sentence is, things couldn't have been any worse. And then about 100 words later, you get the phrase, had Harry thought that things couldn't have been any worse, he was wrong.
He was wrong. I literally drew an arrow and I was like, had he thought that? Yes, right here. Right, 100 words ago, Harry.
Right.
Yeah. It says like there was no reason on earth that Professor McGonagall would accept for them being out of bed and the creeping around the school in the dead of night, let alone being up in the tallest astronomy tower, which was out of bounds except for classes. And it's like there's no reason on earth she would accept. Like, well, let me tell you one reason you didn't try was the truth.
Yes. This is, I think the same thing happens a couple of pages later where like Harry has finally like resigned himself to be like, you know, no, like we've gotten in too much trouble. We're not going to do anything anymore. And,
Two sentences later, he's like, wait a minute, should I poke around?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, what I was going to say is that, like, basically, Hermione is just like, we have to go to Dumbledore. Like, that's the thing to do. And it's like, it's amazing to me how often for Harry, Ron, and Hermione, the answer is not going and asking an adult for help.
Right.
Like, it's always like, well, we can rule that out for sure.
That's not happening. We're not supposed to know about Fluffy or the stone.
Right. You think any of these adult teachers are here to help us students? It's like, yeah. No way. No way.
Do they care if someone's stealing the stone? No, they'll just be mad that we know about it at all.
Right. And then it's suspicious. And yeah, so it's always kind of hilarious. Once again, though, at the end of that first paragraph, we also get the line, and they may as well be packing their bags already.
Just getting out of here.
It's once again where I really think that for like the first three books, this is just like, so it's such a persistent sentiment, is that like fear Of being expelled.
That, like, we broke the rules and that's it.
Right. Like, it's well established that, like, at this point in time, and which is kind of interesting, and like, it's probably part of the greater arc of the story, is that, like, for Harry in his first year, kind of over and over again, the worst thing that can happen is expulsion.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, as you get further in the book, the worst thing that can happen is Harry dies.
Yeah.
You know, or Voldemort comes back, or both.
Well, I mean, he's threatened to, I mean, he almost dies in this chapter.
I'm curious about that. Well, let's just touch on it right now. Do you think that Harry's life is genuinely and completely in danger, or do you think that Voldemort is too weak in this instance?
I think he could have killed him.
Do you? Okay. Yeah. Oh, man.
I mean, because that's not just Voldemort. It's also Quirrell there, too.
See, yeah, I guess so. This is like one of those where I feel like if they were powerful enough between the two of them, Quirrell and Voldemort, to kill Harry in this moment, it almost doesn't seem like Ferenczi should have been able to like falter them back.
Well, I guess they're not like super strong. They are drinking the unicorn blood, which will only keep you alive if you're an inch from life.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yes.
So they aren't super strong, but the way Bane talks about it, it's like Ferenczi shouldn't have interfered because Harry was going to die.
See, but my bigger thought here is that like especially when you get to that last page and the return of the invisibility cloak. So like basically the clear example, especially for it to be on this night of all nights, like the night that he has to like go and serve his detention. Mm-hmm. To me, it all feels like part of that, like Dumbledore's big plan. Like Dumbledore is like, look, McGonagall, the only, like, we can't do this because we have to set a good example. Like, you know, you can't just like allow certain students to be out in bed at night, no matter how much they are the chosen one. So like, yes, we have to give them the detention. Yes, we should have them serve. What we should probably have them do is go and get like a little bit more of an idea about what's going on. So why not just send them out with Hagrid, who, you know, is why they're in trouble in the first place. He won't really be in any danger, but he might be able to like gather a bit more about what's going on and mm-hmm. what's at play here. Mm-hmm. Like that's, in my mind, it's almost like why else would, like, because they're being punished for being out in the middle of the night, which is supposedly super dangerous. Why send them into something that's even more dangerous?
Oh, I know. I don't know. I mean, maybe he wanted him to learn about Voldemort while he was in the woods.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, because I guess Dumbledore could have known that. I mean, this is the second unicorn that's died, so like Dumbledore could be on to like, oh, he needs unicorn blood. All right, he's going to strike again. Let's try and get him out there on the same night or something.
Well, shoot, even Ferenczi himself is the one who is sort of like, you know, he's talking about unicorn blood and the ability to like bring you back from like the brink of death, and then he literally follows it up with like, don't you know what's hidden in the school at this very moment? The Sorcerer's Stone, the Elixir of Life. You know, it's like...
Yeah, it's like if you hadn't figured it out yet, it's like... Dumbledore is like, yeah, he doesn't know how much he knows.
Yes, yeah, yeah, it's yeah, like, exactly.
All right, we're going to make sure Harry gets all the information. Let's go.
Right, yes. But like, I mean, to me, it's like, if Ferenczi is figuring this out, it's like, for one, why did the centaurs have any idea what's in the school at all? Like, they don't look at the here and now. They look like to the heavens.
I think they think the heavens are talking about the here and now.
Do you think so?
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll get to it.
Okay. You're talking about Mars is bright tonight?
Nope, not even that. Oh, nope, talking about some other stuff.
Okay.
I do think that. Okay, so also the severity, the absolute disappointment McGonagall is like spouting at Neville and Hermione and Harry also just does not feel fair to me. Like the line, I thought Gryffindor meant more to you than this. I was like, oh. Wow.
I know. That would be like a parent being like, I thought you cared about us.
Yeah.
It's like oh, I do. Oh my God. Like,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. No,
it's like, maybe that's really what her strategy is. But then she goes on to say, I've never been more ashamed of Gryffindor students. And I'm like, what? Like, really? For being out of bed is the most shameful thing
yes.
anyone has done. Like, this must happen, I don't know, nightly in this castle.
Oh my gosh.
There are students out of bed all the time. That is like the nature of it, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, and literally, what she says is 4 students out of bed in one night. I've never heard of such a thing before.
Baloney.
I was like, the marauders?
She doesn't know. They don't get caught. They use the map and the cloak appropriately.
So incredibly effectively.
But how effectively could it be because of like hundreds of detentions?
Also true. And then the other one we have is we know that Molly and Arthur Weasley would also, despite being in the same house, would go out in the middle of the night for like late night strolls
and stuff.
It's sort of like, okay, McGonagall, I think
just chill.
Maybe just being like, I mean, possibly she's just being like overprotective and she's just trying to like really make a point.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, like, that's what I have to think. I even think to an extent, sometimes like when Filch is walking them down, I'm like, is Filch just trying to scare them? Is he like being straight up malicious here? Like, because like when he's talking about like, oh yeah, I keep the chains oiled, like that sounds mean. And I believe him that he thinks that that should exist. But then he's like, I'll come back for what's left of them. It's like, are you like under the impression that they're about to die? Like, is that what you're telling them? Like, you're probably gonna die. There's no way you're coming out unharmed. Like, that's like that. You can't possibly think that's justifiable punishment for having been out of bed.
Right, which again, to be clear, because that's the other thing too. He says, "I'll come back at dawn."
At dawn,
for what's left of them. So it's like from 11 o'clock at night until apparently the sun rises.
Yes,
is how long they're intended to be serving detention out in, again, what is referred to as the Forbidden Forest.
Right. It's like, what if they'd been caught leaving the Gryffindor common room to go meet Filch in the entrance hall? You know.
Right. Yeah. It's like,
excuse me. What are you doing out of bed? I'm supposed to be out of bed. Why? I have detention. Why? For being out of bed.
It's like, that's the tension. We'll see you again next
week. Like, Snape's just like waiting there like a lawn chair, like, well, look who's back.
Oh my God, I love the thought of Snape in like a super colorful lawn chair, like his black robe, sitting like super stiffly, but also like possibly has a drink with like a little like umbrella sticking out.
Hello, Potter.
Yeah. I will say though, to Neville's credit, like this is like one of those things where the fact that like Neville is out there, once again, it's like he is trying so hard.
He is,
you know, like I feel like I have a lot of empathy for Neville and like what he's going through in this particular year, because you never really get the vibe going forward that Neville is particularly like Dean and Seamus seem like they're best buds.
Yeah.
And then you've got Harry and Ron who are super tight.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 5 boys in the Gryffindor common room.
Right.
So like, I have to imagine that like Neville has basically come to this boarding school where he's kind of struggling with the coursework. He's not making a ton of friends. And every single time he puts himself out there to try to do the right thing, something really bad happens.
I know.
It's just
he meets a 3-headed dog or falls off his broomstick or.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's like, I mean, the fact that he even had enough courage to get out of bed to try and go and like warn Hermione and Harry that Draco was boasting about like being able to catch him in the middle of the night.
Right.
It's like, this guy is like, I don't know. He's just doing his best.
He's doing his best.
I empathize with Neville.
He's getting caught, losing points.
Yeah, zooming out. So anyway, but the other thing that I always do find particularly interesting about this particular set of circumstances is I know going back to one of the earliest J versus Ben's, there was a question that was quite literally like, who serves detention in the Forbidden Forest? And of course, we were like, Harry, Ron, Hermione, Draco. And then like the question was like, oh, was Neville there? You know, like, and I mean, this is, you know, it had just been like a period of time since we had like last read the books or something like that. But like, it is shocking to me that like, even given the last chapter and like how Ron going to the hospital wing because he's bit by Norbert is the reason that Draco is able to go and collect the book so that Draco knows to be out in the middle of the night so that you can have this particular group of people. It's like, it's very convoluted, but it is also strange to me that the decision was made to exclude Ron from this excursion.
I know, like Neville is in there instead of Ron this time around.
Yes. So this is like another one of those where it's like Neville doesn't, and I mean, it could be the case that like maybe I'll pick up on it more as like we're leafing through the book so methodically for this particular read through. But like, I think Neville seems to really be more prominent than I always remember in book one, and then sort of seem to like fade into the shadows a little bit until like book five,
right?
Like,
when the DA starts
about, yeah. And then he's a very prominent character and sort of like, you know, right, like Luna's counter and stuff. So, mm-hmm. Anyway, just so yeah, I think that's like one of those big things where I'm like, man, that like, you know, the further I get from the books, the more likely I think it is that I will forget that Neville goes on this excursion and not Ron.
So. Yeah, right. It does. Yeah, it's like it, and he doesn't make a big impact really, other than that Draco scares him, and so Draco ends up with Harry. And even that doesn't super matter. It's just that Hermione probably wouldn't have like run when Voldemort shows up and Draco does.
Yeah, right. Which, yeah, I think, you know, shows a little bit of Harry's bravery.
So, yeah, just sort of isolates Harry like one on one.
Yeah,
going on there.
Speaking of isolating Harry, there's another thing that we get in this chapter that Harry is destined to face quite a bit of, which is the phrase that from being one of the most popular and admired people at the school, Harry was suddenly the most hated. This is like a really weird thing that seems to follow. This is almost exactly the Rocky analogy over again, or Creed, if you've seen either any of those movies, where once again, Harry is like remarkably famous and important and keeps foiling the Dark Lord, and also is like not really ever able to achieve proper popularity for like a long time.
Uh-huh.
Like even when he's a Triwizard Champion, people are just mad that he's a Triwizard Champion.
Right, because
like,
he's not old enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like this is one of those where it's like Harry is extremely well known. You get to know why he's the center of attention. Also, most of the time people don't like him for it.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, that's like one of those things where it's like it's hard to imagine in real life a world where someone like Harry just isn't a lot more beloved almost regardless of what happens, mm-hmm, because people know his story.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's like it, and I wonder how much of it's just from like Harry's point of view too, where like, you know, oh my God, everyone hates me for this or something.
That's a really good point.
I do think, I mean, I think Harry is pretty popular for the most part. I mean, he's like Quidditch captain and he goes out with like the, you know, apparently asks Parvati Patil, the best looking Gryffindor girl, to, you know, the Yule Ball, and then otherwise dates Ginny and Cho, the other two most popular girls at school or whatever.
This is true.
You know,
this
like, he's not doing so bad.
You know, it actually is extremely funny, even just speaking from my own personal experience, because I think a lot of people have this in high school. Like, I often wonder if anyone, like, you think about, like, the air quotes, like, popular kids you went to school with, and the big question is, like, did any of them see themselves in that regard?
Right.
All like the captain of the football team, whatever, like that guy still has to go home and like climb in bed at night and, you know, like has like his interaction with his family and like, you know, like there's all this like other stuff going on.
Yeah.
But you always see the gloss,
right?
You know, you don't see like the inner workings. I always just think this is interesting because I often know like what my own personal high school experience felt like, and then Ethan, the editor of this very podcast, went to our high school, was in the same grade as our younger brother, and close with him. And I feel like whenever he talks about his perception of me in high school, it's always like, I wish I saw me the way you apparently saw me in high school. So you're right. Like maybe that's one of those things where like Harry is extremely hard on himself, and then is perceiving this negative attention being like magnified in a way where it's like a lot of these kids probably are like a little frustrated you lost like points and might give you like a look because of that, but they're also preoccupied with their own studies and have their own things going on, their own social lives,
right? Yeah,
they're not constantly facing a dark lord.
I can't imagine that like every fifth and sixth and seventh year Gryffindor at this point, like their main concern is the house cup anymore.
That's also true. Know? Yeah, like that's a good point.
Yeah,
like, is like, even right now as I'm like trying to like make this case in my head, it's like, Jay, the house cup is like live or die, man.
I like to think that it is, and that they take it very seriously,
right?
But
right,
you know,
right.
Who's to say?
Yes,
who's to say?
It does seem like you could, by the time you're like a seventh year, you're like, who really cares at this point?
Yeah. Or maybe that's when you care the most, because our other theory is that the points scale, that like, you know, first years aren't able to earn as many points as like seventh years or something.
Well, except
at a
for
time.
The
except
that
they can lose them in spades. Lose,
yeah, in 50 point swaths.
Yeah.
Whew. Any which way.
Not so good. Not so good. Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped because I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to paireyewear.com and use code Griffin for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's paireyewear.com, code Griffin.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Oh, man. So anyway, moving on, we have Harry make his vow to not poke his nose anywhere that he's not supposed to. And then like a page later, he's like, about the week before the exams were due to start, Harry's new resolution not to interfere in anything that didn't concern him was put to an unexpected test. He immediately starts eavesdropping and overhears Quirrell saying, no, no, not again, please. And it sounds like someone's threatening Quirrell. And then he like agrees to it. Harry doesn't see who it is. Assumes it's Snape, but what I think is crazy here is that he just catches Voldemort talking to Quirrell, basically.
I know this is extremely true, and it's like it seems so much more likely that Quirrell would go somewhere like further from, you know, prying eyes. So it is kind of curious, like, you know, what type of like recklessness is going on with this duo here, especially because at this point in time, you would think. I'm trying to get my timetable right, but you would think that they would have already been out and consuming the unicorn blood, right? Or no? Has it maybe not happened yet?
I don't know. When Hagrid gets out there, it's the second unicorn that's died, so maybe they would have by now.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose it could be the case that, like, Voldemort is starting to gain a little bit more power than he's had.
Actually, what Quirrell says, because this is actually one of my questions, was Quirrell says, no, no, not again. It sounded as though someone was threatening him. Harry moved closer. All right. So it's like Harry's interpretation is that Snape is, like, has been torturing Quirrell, and this is him saying, no, don't torture me again. And he's like, all right, here's how you get past my thing. But what is the thing, like, what is the conversation actually going down? He's saying, no, not again. It's like, is Voldemort torturing him or in some way? Or maybe what he's actually saying is like, you need to go kill another unicorn. And he's saying, no, not again.
I think that is extremely likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That totally tracks. We can double check, see as we get a little bit further, if it tells us how long it has been since the other unicorn was found dead in the woods. Because I do think we get a line from that. From Hagrid as they first get out there. So,
yeah, we'll have to double back on that. That could be exactly what it is, though.
I will say that this entire piece of dialogue does, I think, slightly make up for the scene in the woods with Snape, where Snape is like kind of saying one half of a conversation that looks really suspicious based on everything he's saying.
Yeah.
But like, it's like when you know the whole truth, it's like supposed to be looked differently. I feel like we're kind of critical of that one. I do think this particular paragraph could be like to a more savvy reader. And by savvy, what I mean is like when we read these books, we were little kids.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to read it as an adult and be like, okay, I'm starting to think Quirrell might have something weird going on.
Yeah. He's coming up a lot.
Yeah. It's like, why are we talking about Quirrell so much? Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Which is also kind of interesting. Okay. So let's see here.
Harry loses a bet for 12 Sorcerer's Stones.
Yes, he does. Wow.
Going all in.
Talk about a piece of trivia, though. I can just hear it already. It says, how many Sorcerer's Stones would Harry have bet that Snape had just left the room talking to Quirrell? I'd be like, goodness gracious. Mm. I mean, like, three Sorcerer's Stones seems like... One Sorcerer's Stone seems like a lot.
Seems like more than one. Yeah, it's about enough for... More than enough for two people, apparently.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Okay.
Oh, there's also like, they're like, oh, Snape's done it, said Ron. Quirrell's told him how to get past his anti-dark force spell. I love the way they have to like classify, like they don't know what it is yet, so that's what they just keep calling it. But then he says, like, I bet there's a book in here telling you how to get past a giant three-headed dog. And it's like, I mean, I love that they must just not know about like Avada Kedavra at all, because otherwise it'd be like, well, yeah. And that's another thing. It's like, why doesn't Quirrell just kill Fluffy?
Yeah,
you know,
it's a good question.
There's all this like, we got to get a dragon egg and get Hagrid drunk and trick him into telling us how to do it. It's like a living creature. That would work on it, right?
Yeah, right. No, it does seem like with their powers combined, there should be something that they would be capable of doing to overcome Fluffy.
Yeah,
like that seems highly likely.
I guess maybe it's a giveaway. Like, maybe, ideally, you just get around Fluffy, get the stone, get out, and then Fluffy's still there, and no one even knows it's gone.
Right. That's a good point as well. Yeah. Like, if the dog is, you know, Fluffy's just found dead, it's sort of like, well, that's, you know, kind of revealing.
Yeah.
The other distinct possibility here is that we know that Voldemort is in a rather weakened state, even in his occupation of Quirrell. So, yeah. And we know that, like, I mean, at least according to Mad-Eye Moody / Barty Crouch, everybody in Harry's fourth year class could cast Avada Kedavra at him at once. He wouldn't get so much as a bloody nose. So it's like, it could be the case that Quirrell is just quite literally not a powerful enough wizard to Avada Kedavra something.
That's possible. I mean, he also doesn't reach for this spell when Voldemort commands him to kill Harry.
Right, yeah.
You know,
he goes for
physically choking him or something. Like, dude.
Ironically, something, you know, I mean, not that you could even really think about it, but like just any type of physically attacking Harry as a baby probably would have worked a lot better than magically attacking.
Yeah.
Which is really the only way that Lily's protection comes into effect at all. But either way, not the point.
Well, I think even if he devoted cadaver to him, I think the same thing would have happened. Like, Lily's protection would that have still worked, do you think?
Wait, what do you mean?
Like, if in the chamber Quirrell had cast Avada Kedavra, do you think Lily's protection would have continued to protect Harry from the spell?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, I absolutely do.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. In
right.
that case.
Because, yeah, this is Voldemort's conundrum. That's what he's trying to overcome when he takes the blood in.
Right.
As much as being able to physically touch him, is able to magically touch him. Unfortunately, by taking the blood into him, he prevents himself from being able to magically touch him. He's in a lose-lose the moment Lily takes the dive.
At some point in this saga, we will spend an enormous amount of time breaking down just how Voldemort is in his own way over and over and over. Like, he's his own problem. He's his own biggest obstacle.
He absolutely is. Harry is just like all of his like shortcomings like personified, but he like creates Harry basically.
Yes. So as we move forward onto the next page, we get to the 11 o'clock hour when Harry, Hermione, Neville, and Draco are all meeting Filch to be taken out to Hagrid's hut. This is again where it seems like Filch is sort of bringing up like all of the old punishments that apparently they supposedly used to do, such as hanging you by your wrist from the ceiling for a few days. He says, I've still got the chains in my office. Keep them oiled just in case they're ever needed. I am willing to bet that those chains have literally never been used before.
I know. This is one of the things. It's like if the fact that he has the chains suggests that the chains were used, but like, why would you ever do this to your students? You know, like what version of the school is it where you're like, oh yeah, magic school, pretty rough. Sometimes they hang you in the dungeon, straight up torture you. You know?
Yeah, yeah, no, it just doesn't seem,
it doesn't seem
remotely likely to me. So I'm thinking that this is just like one of those things where, and to your point, I think it's like, it's entirely possible what Filch is really trying to do, because he lays it on so thick that it's like, it does seem to me a little bit like what Filch is really like doing is just trying to be like, hey, don't mess up. There are scary things that we can do. This is
the staff really leans into the like, we're gonna scare these kids straight.
Yeah, pretty much.
Are they in danger? No, but are we gonna let them know that? Absolutely not.
Right. Just let them be terrified, and then they'll never go out in the middle of the night ever again.
Exactly, unless we make them.
Precisely. Case in point, exactly now.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's see here. Yeah. So then they get out there. They discover that they're doing detention with Hagrid, which is awfully convenient considering it's Hagrid's fault that they're there in the first place.
Oh my gosh, I know. So okay, so they get the note. Yeah, and it says he half expected Hermione to complain that this was a whole night of studying lost, but she didn't say a word. Like Harry, she felt they deserved what they'd got. And I'm like, do you guys really feel that way? You're not mad at Hagrid at all for this situation?
Yeah.
Like, it is 1,000% his fault. One, not only that Quirrell now has the information to get past Fluffy, which you haven't figured out yet, but two, that you got caught moving a dragon to, like, he is the one who did wrong and you got in trouble. Why are you not mad at him?
Yeah. I don't know. Almost even seems like that the whole story is just trying to sidestep that at all. Even the fact that, like, when I was a kid, I don't even know if it would have occurred to me that these were quite literally back-to-back chapters. And so, like, in my mind, it's like, well, it's kind of been a while. You may have just forgotten about the fact that it was Hagrid's fault. And it's like, no, literally, like, 4 pages ago.
it's very Hagrid's fault.
Yeah. So, anyway,
Yeah, Filch saying, I'm much mistaken if you'll all come out in one piece. It's like, geez, man.
I highlighted that, too. It's just like, all right, okay.
Come on. Like, you can't have the students thinking that the school wants them hurt, you know?
Right. It seems like not.
And also, then there's Hagrid who says, that's why you're late, is it? Like, been lecturing them. It's not your place to do that. You done your bit. I'll take over from here. And it's like, that is actually not why they're late. The detention says that it will take place at 11 o'clock. And then it specifically says at 11, they leave the common room. So they are the reason they are late.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like you know, maybe 10:40, y'all. Give yourself a little time to get down there. I mean, I get it. I am perpetually late to all things. So I sort of get being like, you know, we got to be there at 11. It's like, what time is it? 11:02? Should we leave the house? Okay. Yeah. Let's go.
Well, I mean, there's being late for stuff, but then there's being late for like court, you know?
right.
It's like, you don't show up late to stuff that is you're in trouble for.
Right. So, okay. Here's a question for you. Because this sort of crossed my mind for the first time. We've sort of gone on and on about our suggestion that Filch could be a poltergeist, but it also occurred to me while I was reading this chapter, rather, that the description of drinking unicorn's blood, I want to make sure I get the wording exactly right. The blood of a unicorn will keep you alive even if you are an inch from death, but at a terrible price. You have slain something pure and defenseless to save yourself, and you will have but a half-life, a cursed life, from the moment the blood touches your lips. This is something, I mean, for one, you could make the argument that quite literally all of Dumbledore, or all of Voldemort's plans, rather, ultimately end up working against him to the tune of, like, taking Harry's blood, and then Harry's blood being the thing that tethers him to life when he tries to kill him in the forest in Deathly Hallows. It's like, you could make the argument that quite literally everything that happens to Voldemort going forward is due to the fact that he took in
the unicorn's blood.
But the other thing that occurred to me was like, is there any chance that any other characters in the story that we've ever met have drank unicorn's blood? And, like, because that seems...
Oh, and are now living a cursed life.
And I was like, Filch.
Filch.
You know, like, if anything, like, it almost feels like you could make the argument that something happened somewhere along the way, and now what Filch is forced to do is live what is otherwise...
He does have a cursed existence.
Yeah. He does, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, his whole life just seems cruel, and it would be cruel for anybody to continue to employ someone who is so incapable of handling magical maladies in a school full of people that create magical maladies.
Yeah.
But that would be kind of a cursed life.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's an interesting thought. Yeah, has anyone else in the story drinking unicorn blood?
Yeah.
Hmm.
It reminds me a little bit of, like, The Good Place, the TV show, which, you know, like, major spoilers for the plot of season 1 inbound. I'll give you just a second to exit away in case you need to. But the basic premise is that, like, you know, they're brought to a place that is perceived as the good place, but the actual con that is going on is that what they're actually doing doing is living in the bad place.
Right.
And so, like, for example, that may take forms in ways that you don't necessarily imagine. For example, like, one character, Chidi, is presented with two potential love options, and he is really bad at making decisions. So his worst nightmare is having to make a choice between who to love.
Right.
And it's like, you normally think of Cursed Life being so, like, dark and destitute, more almost like what Filch is actually describing,
right?
Like hanging from a chain or something, something truly terrible and awful. But in this particular case, it would just be like a completely and utterly aggravating and demeaning kind of existence.
Right, yeah. It's, you just know, like, it's this just itch, like, that can't be scratched.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yes. And so that was my thought, was I was like, okay, here's a different explanation that isn't the same one we're always going on about.
Oh, Filch is the poltergeist?
Yes,
which
exactly.
He totally is.
Which, yeah, yeah, most likely. Yeah.
More like, or I guess he drank unicorn blood. Who knows? Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. I love, there's this line too from Hagrid where he says, "You've done wrong and now you've got to pay for it." And I'm like, dude, no, they didn't. He's saying it to Malfoy, but it's like you're implying it about the other three, okay? And then I love Malfoy saying, "If my father knew I was doing this," and he says, "He'd tell you that's how it is at Hogwarts." And I'm like, no, he would not. Dude, literally 2 books from now, he's going to try and get you fired because Buckbeak scratches Draco.
yeah, this is true. But it does make you wonder whether or not, I mean, Hagrid predates Lucius attending school by quite a bit. So it does make you wonder whether or not Hagrid witnessed any of Lucius's own dealings,
sure,
at school while he was there as a student.
Yep.
The one thing that I did underline that I was just sort of like, well, that's not the worst idea, but is following up almost this exact sentiment you just described, which is you'll do something useful, which I do think is sort of like, all things being equal, as far as just general detentions go, maybe not going into the Forbidden Forest in the middle of the night, mm-hmm, where a Dark Lord could just be prowling and killing unicorns. But I do think the idea of providing a like useful service that you could even like it can come across as punishment, but also give the person like a sense of accomplishment.
I mean, yeah, even the next year, like Ron has to go polish all the trophies and in the trophy room,
right,
as part of his punishment, and Harry has to help Lockhart answer his fan mail. That, you know,
I'm saying useful stuff.
Yeah. Very useful, but things got done. Harry can say he can put a peacock feather in his cap, probably.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I also like in here, he says, "Copying lines, what's that's good to anyone?" And it's like, it's so funny that he specifically says copying lines, because that's exactly like that. It's so pointless because it's exactly what Umbridge makes everyone do, is copy lines.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's like
with their own blood.
Yeah, hers is like not useful to anyone and quite painful.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So here we go. Here's the line that we were looking for. So they reach the edge of the Forbidden Forest. They haven't even, I think, entered yet when Hagrid is already able to spot the unicorn blood. He says, "Look there," said Hagrid. "See that shining stuff on the ground, silvery stuff? That's unicorn blood. There's a unicorn in there, been hurt badly by Summit. This is the second time in a week. I found one dead last Wednesday. We're going to try and find the poor thing." So last Wednesday, how long has it been?
Let's see. This is still pre-exams, I believe.
Right.
And when he hears Quirrell talking to Voldemort, it is about a week before the exams were due to start. So, yeah, if this is about a week before they were due to start, and they go into the forest before the exams, that means it's less than a week's worth of time. So last Wednesday would have been before the conversation with Quirrell.
Okay. In that case, then in my mind, the pleading that Quirrell has with Voldemort inside of his own head, the no, not again, please, is almost certainly
about killing another unicorn.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I think that makes sense to me too.
Which I don't think I've ever fully connected those dots in the past.
No, so, me neither.
So. Maybe that's one of those things that was just very evident, but it had never occurred to me. So, okay, we'll take that. Let's see. What do we have next then? So they go into the woods. They split up. Malfoy wants to go with Fang. So it's Malfoy, Fang, and Neville, which just seems like a recipe for disaster, if you ask me.
It's another bit of hypocrisy as well there, because Hagrid first says, "There's nothing that lives in the forest that'll hurt you if you're with me or Fang." And Draco's like, "Fine, I want Fang." And Hagrid's like, "Fine, but he's useless." like, but wait, you just said nothing will hurt you if you're with Fang. Like, which is it, man?
Hagrid, inconsistent.
Who knew?
Yeah.
I don't think Yeah. It's like, oh boy, going over it with a fine-tooth comb sometimes, it's like really stands out.
Yes, yes indeed. There's the sparks that they have to send out of the end of their wand. This is always one of those things that I wonder, like, if you have an actual wand, because they don't really specifically talk about it necessarily, but it seems like throwing out sparks is almost like the easiest. It's like not even classified as like a spell,
right? It's just like, yeah, everyone can do that. Just red, green. Like, even Neville successfully does it.
True,
you know,
true,
like
true,
in
true.
This chapter, like even Neville could send out red sparks
under pressure.
Yeah,
there we go. Okay, so that's because they do this again in Goblet of Fire. This is like the way that they're supposed to, like, you know, indicate like if something is wrong.
Right.
I do wonder if it's just sort of like extremely, extremely simple.
Right.
Like point and gesture, and out will come sparks.
Right, yeah. I mean, I guess by then you'd expect, you know, they're supposed to be seventh year, so you'd expect them, of course, to be able to send sparks out. But, like, even first years are apparently just like, yeah, you can do that, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's basic magic.
Seems simple enough. There's a lot of talk of werewolves being out in the Forbidden Forest in this chapter, which is kind of interesting because there's not really any reason for there to be werewolves living in the Forbidden Forest.
Yeah, this could be, like, one of those. There's, like, a couple explanations, I suppose, that you could perhaps, that, like, if you are a werewolf, you are sort of shunned by society, like, even in your human form. So, like, maybe you've just maybe there are human werewolves who take refuge in the forest in the meantime or something, which would seem unlikely, but I guess possible, because they actually do. There is a line that says the moon was bright. So it's like, it doesn't say it was a full moon, but it kind of suggests that it is, because it's like casting shadows. It's so bright this particular night. So it's like, it's possible that if there are human werewolves, like even if maybe they don't live in the forest in the meantime, that, like, on this night is a night of werewolves, because it is a full moon.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah,
that
so tracks. They might have just broken out of wherever they normally live and gone into the forest, which is sort of what Lupin does eventually when he transforms.
I guess that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, that was my big thing, though, is that it, and I guess you make a good point, like, they could just have colonies that, like, living sort of, like, separate from society, which I think Lupin does say, like, in... Is it Half-Blood Prince, where he's doing missions for... Dumbledore,
yeah,
and he's been, like, trying to go and, like, plead with the werewolves to, like, not fall, you know, to Voldemort. Yeah, to Voldemort. Yeah. So I guess that's reasonable. But yeah, as I was reading it, I was just sort of like, they're people.
Yeah, know? Right. Like, what are you talking about? Although that's also one of those things. If you ever play Hogwarts Legacy and you're wandering in the forest, there are, like, people who are otherwise werewolves just, like, out there.
Oh, are there really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's
kind of interesting. That takes place a long time before now, so who's to say it's the same?
Right.
But
right.
That is, like, and that's a game, and they just want to give you, you know, things to fight in the woods. So
that's fair. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting.
Yep.
Okay.
So that's in there as well. But I love also where he's just like, he's not that concerned that they're going to get hurt, but he's also never known anything that could hurt a unicorn before. And that's out there. So let's go.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. I mean, it does feel a little bit like, okay, this must be something pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
We also get, like, a little bit of Hagrid's prowess a little bit as he is going. Let's see here. I think that there's... What is the sound? The three of them listened. Something was slithering over dead leaves nearby. It sounded like a cloak trailing along the ground. Hagrid was squinting up the dark path, but after a few seconds, the sound faded away. I knew it, he murmured. That's someone in here that shouldn't be. This is almost like sort of like that mechanic that you know that can, like, you pull in and he's like, oh, your fourth cylinder is firing wrong, huh? And it's like, you could just tell by the way it, like, sounds. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like, this is one of those where you're like, man, Hagrid must really know the Force.
Right. Like, he can, like, tell that this sound does not belong here at all.
Right. It's like, yeah, this is not, like, some creature, you know, that maybe is, like, unusual to be here. It's like, this is not at all supposed to be here.
Right.
So, okay, that's the other question too then. Do you think that in this particular situation that this is both Quirrell and, I mean, I guess it would be, again, if we go back to the pleading, but, like, the slithering has always sort of led me to believe that this is more of, like, the shadowy cloak of an existence that Voldemort is of his on his own.
I don't think he can really leave Quirrell. I think it's Quirrell with it Voldemort is on the back of his head, and it just sounds like slithering because it's a cloak going over leaves.
Okay that's fair enough. Let's see,
So then we meet the centaurs. Yes, we have Ronan and Bane show up and continue. This is what about just my, I love they keep, Hagrid keeps asking them questions and they're just like, Mars is bright tonight. Yeah, we've heard.
this is always one of me and you's favorite quotes to say from the whole series. It's just absolutely hilarious because like Hagrid's trying so hard to like keep asking questions and the centaurs are just sort of like, yeah, we're just going to keep kind of like sidestepping it, which as soon as you talk to like Ferenczi, you pretty much learn like that this is part of their culture. So like part of me almost wonders whether or not like, are they preoccupied and not really listening to Hagrid, or are they just being like intentionally evasive? And
they know exactly what's up. And that, I think like the way they're phrasing it back to him is just like, oh, you know, oh, have you seen anything strange? It's like the forest hides many secrets. And it's like Ferenczi knows exactly that it's Voldemort. And it's like, just say Voldemort, dude.
Right.
It's like you're being vague so on purpose here. But I guess they're like, we shouldn't interfere is what the star says. We're allowed to know what they say, but we can't tell people what they say. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah. So this is sort of interesting because I was trying to think about in like other fiction, whether or not like a watcher is a kind of like consistent character. So the closest thing that came to mind for me is the Watchers from like the Marvel.
Oh yeah, Uatu.
Yeah. And it's sort of like it's a strange kind of involvement to have with the greater world, mm-hmm. because it's sort of like you're tuned in, like you're seeing the signs, you're capable of like reading like the stars, the planets, like what's happening and like what's coming. But it's hard to know like what type of role inaction can have. Like is it common for there to be this entity in stories in real life, like where there's someone who's just sort of like watching from afar and like letting it all unfold?
Right. I don't know, but I think what's interesting about the centaurs is, and the way that they read the stars, is that they are like pretty accurate about the things they read. But like what Ferenczi later tells the class in Order of the Phoenix is that while the stars can tell you what the future is, it's not like really precise about the timing of stuff. Like things can be off by like, I don't know, like decades or something or whatever.
Sure.
You know, like, yes, we're in a period, we're like in a brief peace between two wars or something, but it's like, we don't know when the other war is going to happen, but it's definitely going to happen, you know?
Right. Yeah. Which, I mean, to be fair, I mean, we literally know that Lily and James were involved with the First Wizarding War, and Harry is directly involved with the Second Wizarding War.
Yeah.
So if you want to call this space in between peace, which if you're Harry, I'm sure you don't.
Yeah, right. Like,
I had no peace in my department.
Yeah, right.
This whole time.
Yeah, but if you're like Fudge, you're like, everything's great. We're back to normal. He who must not be named is gone. Amazing. Right.
Everything's amazing.
Yeah.
Yep. So we get the exchange with the centaurs though, where they basically are just not super keen to let anything on at all.
Then we split up and Hagrid, or what is it? Neville and Malfoy go one way, and Harry and Hermione and Hagrid. I love how Hagrid's just like, yeah, you two, my favorite students, you come with me.
Yeah. Why not? Why not? Yeah,
that'll it'll work be great. Well. Then they go out there. Malfoy pulls a trick on Neville. Harry's like, I don't care if Malfoy has, but if something's got Neville, it's our fault he's out here in the first place. I was just like, actually, it's Hagrid's fault. Then they switch up, and then we get to the hooded figure. So eventually they switch places, and then we get to the point where they find the unicorn, and out of the shadows, a hooded figure came crawling across the ground like some stalking beast and began to drink the unicorn's blood. Blah. Real scary.
It is pretty intense.
Yeah.
But once again, I mean, this is another one where it to me, like the, like came crawling across the ground. I mean, it's, I don't know. This is again where I feel like I'm like, part of me is not picturing Quirrell in like a truly like pathetic state. It just seems so much more menacing.
Well, I think Voldemort says Quirrell has to be the one drinking the blood for him.
Okay.
Because I think the other thing is that it's not even Voldemort. Like Voldemort isn't even the one who needs the potion. Right, or needs the unicorn blood.
Voldemort
already has the Horcruxes. He already can't die. He needs Quirrell to stay alive because he's basically acting like a parasite to Quirrell.
So yeah, like his raising strength, if anything, is probably slowly depleting Quirrell's ability to exist.
Right. I mean, it's not unlike the diary and Ginny. It's like the more he takes from Quirrell, like the more he takes from Ginny, the more he's about to come back to life.
I like that.
You know?
Okay.
So there's that. I think he also just says it's the Quirrell drinking it for him at one point.
Yes. Then we immediately, though, I mean, so Malfoy, you know, sort of runs away in total fear. It doesn't say, like, Harry says that he is, it got to its feet and came swiftly towards Harry. He couldn't move for fear. So this is kind of interesting because, like, Harry over and over will be faced with essentially this exact situation, paralyzing fear, like where you know, he needs to either like face down the challenge before him. And in some ways it's almost like it's fascinating the contrasting forms of fear that Harry has versus Draco. Like Draco runs from the fight,
right?
Basically. And Harry is sort of like fixed in place. But this is one of those things like about Harry where, I mean, I remember playing Capture the Flag at night as a kid of Harry's age and being terrified, like walking through the woods by myself.
Right.
And so like there is a part of me that's almost like, man, like this kid's got some guts.
Oh, for sure.
You know, to be out there. Like, I mean, he's definitely got like his, you know, I mean, it says that he's afraid, but like, I mean, I feel like that's where you can tell like those, that true Gryffindor nature is like burning its way through.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if this is like fight or flight, like Draco clearly is in flight and Harry does not.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
but I guess some people say it's like fight or flight or freeze. So or maybe freeze. He's more like frozen this time.
Maybe he's more frozen in this case, but either which way. He definitely experiences the excruciating pain in his scar, which is definitely letting us know that like pretty much what he's encountered is Voldemort.
Absolutely. It's interesting though that if it's like, like what must be, you don't get a great, yeah, you're right. It's like the, what is underneath the hooded figure is like kind of vague. Like I feel like you're like Quirrell has to be there, but why is it hurting him so much in this particular case that he's making like face-to-face contact with Quirrell? Cause like Voldemort's head would still be the wrong way. Right. Or is it like, was Voldemort the one drinking the blood and now he's like actually facing Harry right here? Or is it just like,
I suppose on some level, like what you would assume, I mean, like, you know, we know for the book's sake, the overall plot of having a story, you know, in the setup and the eventual obstacles and going beneath the school and getting past Fluffy and the flying keys and the potions and all that type of stuff, the chessboard. But I mean, I suppose for all intents and purposes at this point in time, Voldemort could just quite literally just be straight up prepared to attack and attempt to kill Harry.
Yeah.
And Ferenczi just intervenes.
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening, too, is that quickly, he's preparing to kill him.
Yes.
Because, and I mean, and I'll talk more about that in a second. But yeah, Ferenczi shows up, chases Quirrell / Voldemort off, and then Ronan and Bane show up, and they're all like, what are you doing? Bah. So the first thing, what is it? Bane says, what have you been telling him? Remember, Ferenczi, we're sworn not to set ourselves against the heavens, which just like the way, like that sentence alone is like, they know something. Like there is something to have been told. It's true. Like, you know, it's like, little did he know, you know, it's like, that means it's something you don't know.
right. Yeah. Yeah.
What have you been telling him? That means there's something to tell, you know?
Right. Yeah. That does mean, that means that there is something. Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. So there's that. And then, Bane kicked his legs back for the best. What is that to do with us? Centaurs are concerned with what has been foretold. So it's like, okay, but what has been foretold, you know?
Right.
In that moment. And then, it says, do you not see that unicorn Ferenczi bellowed to Bane? Do you not understand why it was killed, or have the planets not let you in on that secret? And it's like, so even that, it's like they're all speaking in vagueisms because they're in front of Harry, but it's like he's saying, it's like, yeah, we all know what that was and why that happened. Doug, it's right there written in the sky. Come on.
Right.
You know,
right. Like they clearly know more about what's going on. And what's almost surprising is that like if they are tuned into it in any capacity, or maybe Ferenczi is just taking this on himself, but like it is almost surprising that Voldemort / Quirrell has been able to come out there and do it more than once without being stopped.
Mm.
You know, like,
well, they don't care about that. I think what they're mad about is that he's stopping from killing Harry.
I see.
Yes.
Because,
and this is where I get, this is the awesome foreshadowing in this particular chapter. Oh, why Bane is so upset that Ferenczi stopped Voldemort from killing Harry in the Forbidden Forest is because it is written in the sky that Voldemort is going to kill Harry in the Forbidden Forest, which he eventually does.
Wow.
I know. And I think that is so crazy. And he's so mad at him for interfering, but it's exactly what Firenze says in Order of the Phoenix. They're like, the planets get it right. They're just not very good with the timing. It's hard to know when it's going to happen. But if you're the Centaurs and you're like, okay, Dark Lloyd going to kill Harry in the forest. Well, God, all the pieces were right here. That had to be it. Firenze, are you crazy?
That's a, you know, that's a slam dunk right there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that is, I think that is insane.
It's so true. It's so interesting.
It gets better. It gets better. Because okay, yeah, if that's what's supposed to happen, the Centaurs don't join the fight at the Battle of Hogwarts until after Harry is killed by Voldemort. Because at that point to them, like what the stars have said has come true.
Has come true.
Yeah.
So even then they're not even like preoccupied with the fact that Harry comes back.
Right.
Oh, it's so interesting.
It's crazy.
That is amazing. Because the other thing I've always found to be interesting about the fact that Voldemort is waiting for Harry in the woods is like he's all over the place during Deathly Hallows, during the Battle of Hogwarts, mm-hmm. where like he's in the Shrieking Shack with Snape and like that whole situation. Then he's like, I'll be waiting in the forest for Harry. And it's like, why the forest?
Yeah, what are you doing?
What an inconvenient place to be.
I know, just like need a place to retreat, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, but it has to be the forest. Because it always was going to.
It was always
going to
be in the forest. Yeah. Oh man. I was like, man, that's really good.
You're right.
Yeah.
Oh man. I never thought about it that way before.
So there you go. That's why the Centaurs are so mad that Firenze interferes here, because like they know this is supposed to happen.
This is where it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Even and with Hagrid. Hagrid's even
supposed Hagrid's to be, even there. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like everything is really on the chessboard, as it were. And if you're like looking at it, and of course, like Firenze intervening is also part of it because it's not supposed to happen yet. But I can see why they're upset. Gosh, I love the conversation that he goes on to have with Harry and tells him, you know, the blood of a unicorn will keep you alive, even if you're an inch from death, but at a terrible price, but you'll have a half life, a cursed life. And Harry says, but who'd be that desperate? If you're going to be cursed forever, death's better, isn't it?
And I
know, I like circled it. I was like, death's better, is it? It's like Harry as an 11-year-old already gets it.
It's the whole theme.
It's the whole thing.
I literally highlighted it. And I wrote next to it, hey, that's the theme of the whole story.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. I mean, like in book one, Harry has already got it figured out.
Death's better, isn't it? Cursed forever. It's like Voldemort's already cursed forever anyway without the unicorn blood because of the Horcruxes. So it's like, there's that.
Right.
Like,
yes.
He's like, he curses himself in so many different ways.
Well, and again, going back to that big finale where Harry does walk into the forest. I mean, basically what Harry is saying is like to allow Voldemort to live would be basically subjecting all of humanity, all of wizard kind at the bare minimum to a cursed life. And so for Harry, death's better.
Death's better.
And yeah.
It all comes very full circle here in the forest.
That's incredible.
Oh man.
I can't, my mind is just being blown.
and then the next page, Harry realizes, or he just thinks back to that conversation with Hagrid where he says, don't know if he had enough human left in him, did I? And it's like, oh, like Hagrid is so actually spot on the money with that particular sentiment that Voldemort does not have enough human left in him to die. Like he cannot die.
Right.
Or he can't even when Harry defeats him, he does not die true, like a true death in the traditional sense.
Right.
Like when Harry goes to like the limbo spot in King's Cross and he sees like the gross little baby, like that is the preview of Voldemort's destiny. Like he doesn't, you know, Harry's able to get up and walk around and choose to move on or whatever. Voldemort, when he is defeated by Harry later on, that is where he is stuck. So he is not like able to choose to come back as a ghost. He is just stuck in limbo forever. He doesn't have like the death experience. Like you couldn't call him back with the resurrection stone.
Yeah, no, and I think that's exactly it, is that like, yeah, like Harry enters King's Cross Station, which is his version or manifestation inside of limbo. But limbo is, I mean, it you know, I guess some of the question there is like, was Dumbledore, is, oh man, that's a whole big question in and of itself. Is Dumbledore waiting in limbo for Harry to get there?
Or does he just like return to limbo to speak to him or something?
Right.
That's a good question. I don't know.
It seems like when we have to save for King's Cross Station, like 3 years from now.
Yeah, 3 years from now when we get to King's Cross.
Yeah, that'll be a good one.
The other Oaks, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, speaking of Dumbledore, we're making it to our second to last page here and really kind of like the closing sentiments. And there, Hermione, I think, is talking and says, Harry, everyone says Dumbledore's the only one you know who was ever afraid of. And this is kind of like a curious sentiment. Like, I know it to be true. Like, this is not like a fact that like blows my mind. Or like, I haven't forgotten that this is true. But like, just as you're reading through, it's kind of like, I wonder why Voldemort fears Dumbledore. Like, I almost wonder if this is like one of those things where Voldemort was able to unearth enough about Dumbledore's past that he knows, because it seems unlike Voldemort, or it seems more like Voldemort, to underestimate his opposition. Mm-hmm. And this is almost like adequately respecting Dumbledore, which almost to me makes me think like he's aware that Dumbledore might be capable of like some dark stuff himself.
Well, but then you'd think he'd have recognized the picture with Grindelwald or who the sandy faced boy was a lot faster.
You would think that. That's a good point. Yeah, you definitely would. So I don't know. I mean, maybe the involvement with Grindelwald is lesser known.
Dumbledore would have been one of his professors at school. So true. I guess he would have just been able to like see him do magic there and stuff as well. I don't know.
Right. But you would think that Voldemort would think that he was just stronger.
I guess Voldemort would have been in school when Dumbledore defeated Grindelwald, right?
I think it's like right in that zip code, because this is always the thing with Fantastic Beasts that I was so eager to learn. But the saga starts, I think, in 1926, which also happens to be the year that Voldemort is born.
Right.
So then how does that math work?
Well, so because the chamber is open the first time in 1942.
Right.
Because that's 50 years ago, which is the year Hagrid is expelled.
Correct.
And the duel happens in 1945. So... either I don't know what year Tom Riddle is. It a fifth year in that? In
I think there? He's a fifth year.
So I guess by the time 1945 rolls around, it's either like the spring semester or he's graduated.
Yeah,
Hogwarts at that point.
Yeah.
So either way, he's going to have very like Dumbledore defeating Grindelwald. It's going to be like have been incredibly, you know, public knowledge. And if that's otherwise the greatest dark wizard of all time, and that's what you're trying to be, and this guy defeated him, like. It seems like that, you know, you could be afraid of him.
You could be afraid of him. I mean, certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's just that, like, I feel like when you talk about Grindelwald fearing Dumbledore a little bit, it seems like it's because, like, even to Dumbledore's own admission, like, he knows, Grindelwald knew that Dumbledore was a shade better wizard.
Yeah.
Like, but this is, like, one of those things where, like, it doesn't seem like up until the Battle of the Department of Mysteries that Voldemort would face him head on.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I just think it's curious, you know. I mean, like I guess it's just simply because it almost feels like Voldemort would think that it goes back to that line from McGonagall in the first chapter, which is just like, you're too noble to do the dark things that Voldemort might do. Like maybe even that's what Voldemort realizes, is like, it's like all it would take would be Dumbledore not being noble, and then I would lose.
Oh, right. Like if I'm only the greatest dark wizard because Dumbledore is not choosing to be dark.
Exactly. Yes. Right. Yeah. So maybe that's a piece of it.
Right.
But then, of course, yeah, to close out, we then learn that Dumbledore has, in fact, recovered the invisibility cloak and returned it to Harry folded up inside of his sheets in his bed with the note that says, just in case.
Yeah. Meaning that Dumbledore went up, enough to go looking for Harry's invisibility cloak, recover it, and I feel like probably knows the whole story about the dragon.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like the type of thing that Hagrid would lie to Dumbledore directly about. Nor at this point in time do I think that Hagrid would worry that, even given the circumstances, that Dumbledore would fire him for such a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway. Okay, Jay. Well, I think that closes us out of chapter 15. We are into the final two chapters of the entire book. The end is in sight, which is very exciting.
I know.
Looking forward to chapter 16, Through the Trap Door. Do you have a review for us before we close out?
I sure do. This review is from Lizanne. It says, so much fun. This podcast is so much fun. It prompted me to re-listen to the books again. Did make me question, why is the Bloody Baron the only person/ghost that Peeves listen to? I'm wondering what your guys' take is on that. Which is, I got that question. I was like, you know what? I've never really thought about it. I've always just sort of thought the Bloody Baron was scary looking, and that's why Peeves was scared of him.
I know. That's a good question. Okay, so let's try to think a little bit here. The Bloody Baron would have at least existed. The Bloody Baron would have existed at the same time as the Founders.
Yeah, because he knows Salazar, or he knows Rowena Ravenclaw, who was alive at the same time as, or he know he the Bloody Baron wants to marry Helena Ravenclaw,
right.
Helena Ravenclaw, and she is alive at the same time as her mother because she steals the diadem from her.
Correct.
So it suggests that Slytherin is, yeah, the Bloody Baron was taught by Slytherin.
Okay. Yes. Right. Yes. That would suggest that. And so from there, I guess on some level, you know, if he's a Baron, that's a kind of, that's a rank, right?
That's like, some kind of title.
Like a duke?
Like a duke or, yeah, some sort of landowner. And the fact that this is always one of those things that's like, yeah, there's the Baron and he wants to marry Helena Ravenclaw. And what Ravenclaw's like big item is or artifact is a tiara. It's like right. There's a certain amount of like royalty floating around in this area. Stuff.
it almost like one of my like own personal like pieces of headcanon is that the Ravenclaws in the non-wizarding world were of some kind of like nobility.
Mm-hmm.
Like they would be regarded, and maybe their wealth is being created through magic, but people don't know that.
People don't know that.
It's like their closely guarded secret.
Mm.
So I could even see a world where part of like the appeal of leaving that noble lifestyle is going off with the friends, with her friends, her best friends.
With Godric and Salazar and Helga.
Yes, exactly.
Off on the countryside going on adventures.
Going off on adventures, yes, exactly. Because she is like, we are magical, we have a gift, we should be trying to help other people who are like us to harness these abilities and, you know, do good things and learn how to like, you know, learn all the right stuff attached to magic and expand the possibilities. And I could see a world where the nobility would adhere so heavily to exactly the things you see nobility adhere to, which is basically like what it takes to maintain in good standing in society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like optics are so wildly important. All of that to say, though, is basically like it feels like the Bloody Baron, with that title in hand, with the assumption that there's some possibility that Rowena could have been of nobility, that like that you've got some of that world carrying over. And I guess what I'm just trying to imagine is like what.
Like, what does that have to do with Peeves, though?
What does that? No. I know. I mean, I'm trying to like paint the picture of what I think the world could have looked like with these characters in mind. What their like associated positions or roles could have been in the castle. And one of my theories for a long time is that Hogwarts wasn't originally exclusively a school, but maybe like a haven for magical people. And so I'm trying to think if there's any possibility that like the Bloody Baron's role inside of the school could have been quite literally like guarding over the magical manifestations that existed inside of it or something.
That's interesting. That's
like,
interesting.
Like if the Bloody Baron had a job.
Right. Did he have like a job at school is like further than just being a student or something?
Yes. Mm, yes.
I guess that's possible. I think the Bloody Baron predates Peeves. I don't think Peeves has been there like since Hogwarts has been there.
No, I think you're right. I think that we have some history on that if you go into the Pottermore archives as to like when Peeves himself arrives. But I think that also to me suggests that poltergeists can be somehow maybe like not defeated for goodsies, but like maybe they like are reborn.
Mm-hmm. I think there was like a different poltergeist like in the same vein as Peeves before Peeves.
Right.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember. There is like an article about Peeves and like how they tried to expel him once and like trap him in a bell jar. And it's just like, there's really nothing you can do.
Right.
Other than just, you know, him just sort of dissipating because he's not being manifested anymore or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Right. But so basically what I'm trying to think, though, is that as a ghost, you are the imprint of your living self, which makes me think that the Bloody Baron because Professor Binns comes and teaches history of magic.
Yeah.
He's still able to teach history of magic effectively, even as, well, not maybe not effectively, but he's still able to continue to do something he was capable of doing in life.
Yeah.
And so that makes me think that whatever the Bloody Baron did in life also would have granted him some kind of authority over these magical manifestations. That's what I'm going with.
That's what you're going with?
Because I don't have another answer. There's not an in-universe answer.
Right. Yeah. I think, I mean, other than Peeve just seems scared of him.
He does just seem scared of him. Yeah. But again, it's like once you like learn the story, like Bloody Baron sounds like a ship captain gone wrong or something.
Yeah. You're like, he's just like a freaking walking tragedy. You know?
He is just a walking tragedy, but he's otherwise just like a piece of like the gentry, the court, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, he's not really like
okay, here's another explanation. The only other times Peeves listens to anybody is when Fred and George are causing absolute chaos at the school.
True.
So what if the Bloody Baron was just like a total jokester?
He's just like hilarious.
Like he was just this like hilarious life of the party. Everybody loved him. He was causing nonsense everywhere. And he had this huge crush on a girl who did not like him. And that drove him mad. And he eventually like kills himself or whatever.
Okay.
And
I don't completely hate this. Yeah. Because also this would be almost an instance where you could almost see a world where like Rowena sort of like spurs the vision of like her royal family mm-hmm. or whatever. But then like her own daughter maybe takes things a bit more seriously than like Rowena does, who ran away from such nobility to like hang with her friends.
Yeah. But like Rowena is still described as being like haughty and stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe just compared to like Godric
compared
Salad,
to Rhea, yeah. compared to the other ones. Like, yeah, she's like, yeah, she's rebelling against her parents, but like, she's still like, you know, she's still herself. She's still where she came from level. Right.
But
yeah.
Like, so, you know, if she picks the Bloody Baron as somebody who would be a good fit for her daughter, maybe it's somebody who she thinks would help her daughter to like lighten up a little bit.
Maybe.
I'm like so far into like the misty weeds of fanfic right now. Like,
oh, the Bloody Baron, you know, the creepy ghost. He was the laugh, man.
He was the Fred and George before they were there.
He was the first Fred and George. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Studied under Salazar, breaking rules and stuff. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was his own antics that spawned the first ever poltergeist of Hogwarts. Yeah.
Peeves is of him, which is why he could control him.
All I'm really trying to say is this is a good question.
Great question.
I've never truly contemplated before, but no, it's fascinating to think about. So anyway, we'll continue to give it a ponder. Maybe we'll see it in a future theory episode over on Super Carlin Brothers.
Yeah.
In the meantime, though, if you guys are watching over on YouTube, we have begun our quest to attain the silver play button at 100,000 subscribers. So if you happen to be watching via YouTube, I understand that the subscribe button is not what it once was, but it doesn't mean that the play button that comes with it isn't still a very real thing.
It's still there.
We would love to achieve that next goal. So if you wouldn't mind just slapping that subscribe button, it would sure mean a lot to
us. Give it a quick slap. Even if you're just listening, you know what? Just be like, hey, I'm gonna open up YouTube. I don't normally do this, but boom, subscribe.
I don't normally do this.
You know, it doesn't really mean anything. Thing, but it would be really, it'd be really cool.
Yeah, it's your good deed of the day.
Yeah, it's your good deed.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, anyway, thank you so much on our quest to the silver play button, which we can put in the other thing is we have a golden frame black there, so we can put our silver play button in the golden frame.
That's exactly. And then fantastic. we can aspire to
yeah to the gold play button. I don't think this podcast YouTube channel is ever going to have 1 million subscribers.
I never thought our first channel would ever get 1 million subscribers. So anyway.
Well, You know, here's hoping, I suppose.
Stranger things have happened, I guess. That's all. Anyway, guys, as ever, thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time.
We will see... Yeah, next time.
Sorry.
Next time, we will see you through the trapdoor here on Through the Gryffindor.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.